to myself again. But it's the only way you're ever gonna learn. You look back and it's all in the past. I'm dwelling on the thoughts I cannot say to you. If I don't say the words, then maybe it's not. Welcome along to NUFC Matters with me, Steve Wraith. As always, we have a special interview once a week, and it's a delight for me to welcome good friend Yvette Field into the show. How are you, Yvette?
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. Unfortunately, I'm not an expert on football or sport in any way, but my God, when football was on, all I could hear was my dad screaming from the front room as a kid, just growing up with, yeah, get in. He was a huge, huge football fan. And he also, when he was younger, he was one of the young boxers at Salford Boxing Club, you know, the boys club there. So he was really into his sport. So I kind of grew up with it, but I kind of like, I don't know, sort of went a girly way.
Yeah, no problem with that. I mean, where were you brought up, Yvette?
I was brought up in Greater Manchester. People call it Cheshire, but my first home was in Davenport. Then we moved to Bramhall, Poynton. And now I live in Sandbach in Cheshire. I did live in London for about 12 years because I had to, because that's where the work was. I class myself as a Northern lass and a Northerner. And I love our sense of humour. You know, I'm not saying that I'm married to a Southerner. So, you know, and he's got a wicked sense of humour. But I just love the way Northerners are, you know, with each other. I think, you know, we just have such a laugh and we have a great sense of humour and we understand each other, don't we?
Yeah, we do. So I've got to ask you, was your dad shouting for the red or the blue side of Manchester?
Do I say?
You can. It doesn't matter these days. They're both in the Premier League. They're both Newcastle United's rivals.
United. Yeah, he was a United fan all the time. But it was Sunday, I think. Was it match day or was that Saturday?
Yeah, the cup final, didn't they, the weekend? Yeah. They got beat off Manchester City. That was a hell of a day for Manchester, that, though. First time ever.
Yeah, and he actually was squatting on top of the chair because he was so excited. I think he wanted to jump off it, just beside himself. And I got really into football at one point. I actually watched, when England won the World Cup, I watched the whole footage, the whole match, and just watched them and the commentary was so funny, wasn't it? So different and so very polite, you know. It was just wonderful, and I loved it, and to watch how, you know, the game has sort of moved on. I mean, do you think it's, you know, I mean, obviously it's different now to what it was then, but you must know what I'm talking about. The change is so different, you know, and, you know, like, what's that program? I watched it on Netflix. Oh gosh, it's all about the birth of football,
I haven't seen it, but a lot of people keep talking about this on Netflix, and I'm going to have to watch it. It's one of those summer projects when there's no football to watch, so I'm going to tick the box. I know exactly what you mean. I can't place the name of it, but a lot of people have said you need to watch this documentary, so I think I will.
It's like the birth of the FA Cup, isn't it? And how only you know, you sort of. Eatonites were allowed to play, and you know, none of these you know, working class people were allowed to even be involved in the competition, you know, and it's a lovely story. So yeah, you've got to watch that.
Yeah, no, I definitely will. Okay, I know football isn't your strongest point, so let's just get back to just the early days, Yvette. I mean, what did you want to do? You know, were you good at school, and you know, did you have ambitions to get into the career you eventually got into, TV?
Well, first of all, I wanted to be in the army. I was obsessed. Yeah, I wanted to be in the army, and funnily enough, my daughter's now a medic in the RAF. And when she told us, it was like, oh my God, yeah, I'm living vicariously through my daughter, you know, everything that she's gone through and her training. And it's just incredible. And she'll send me photographs of them sort of like they're out on, is it SPT? I can't remember, CPT. And she's got sort of like pretend arms blown off and somebody else having to try and, you know, oh, what do we do in this situation? And some of the stories she tells is absolutely fantastic. And at the moment, she's thinking of maybe retrading and thinking about becoming a pilot. And I'm like, oh my God, well, we'll see that. And I'm so excited because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be in the military. And my dad was like, no, you're not doing that. You're not going in the military. I think it was also at the time, gosh, what war was happening then? Oh my God. Oh, what's the big war? Margaret Thatcher sent everybody in.
The Falklands War.
Falklands, sorry. Yeah, my mind was the Falklands War. And it was like, my dad was like, no, you're not joining the army or anything like that. And I was devastated because I really wanted to do that. And I was rubbish at school, absolutely rubbish. I spent too much time chatting, too much time having a laugh and a joke. And then I was in a play, a Shakespearean play, A Midsummer Night's Dream, and I was a fairy and I loved it. So my mum and dad went, well, hang on a minute. She likes this. She's obviously not going to be something academic. She's not going in the army. You can forget that. And so they put me in stage school, theatre school. So I was really lucky to do that. And that's where I got my first audition for BBC One. And I got a series where I was the lead role in a series called Sea View.
I remember it.
Worst Kevin Keegan hair perm. Absolutely horrific, and the acting was shocking. I mean, absolutely shocking. I mean, oh my God. Anyway, so I did that for 2 years, and then I just went on to college. I studied drama, film studies. I was really into film, and then a couple of jobs here and there, working in a fish and chip shop. My mum used to make me get dressed after I'd finished working in the porch. You stink fish. Get your clothes. You're not coming in this house smelling a fish. So, worked there, cleaned out urinals and toilets. That was another job that I had. And then I worked in a bar. And then I got an audition on Blue Peter. The editor at the time, Biddy Baxter, had seen me on CV and went, oh, we'll keep her in mind for when she's older. And I was 17 and I didn't get the first audition. Karen Keating got it, the beautiful Karen Keating.
Yes.
Yeah. So she got the job, and then they tried me a year later, and I did get the job, and I was just, well, my God, my whole life changed then. Yeah.
Let's go back to the acting before we look at Blue Peter and the acting side of things. I mean, at a young age as well, it can be a bit of a shock, I guess, because you go from doing a stage play. I mean, you and I have got quite a few things in common. I did, you know, A Midsummer Night's Dream at the age of 7. I played Puck when I was 7 years of age. So.
Oh, wow.
We've got some interesting crossovers, which I didn't even know. But the TV stuff, did you find that tiring at such a young age? Because there's a lot of stand around. People out there don't realise that acting, although it looks very glamorous and, you know, going along to maybe the odd award ceremony if you're lucky enough to be at that level, it looks very exciting, but it's very time consuming. There's a lot of standing around. And for a young girl, it must have been quite tiring.
I don't remember being tired. I just remember being so excited. And so I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that I was doing this. I mean, this was so exciting. Now, all I ever wanted to do and all I've ever wanted to do, and I still do it now. So if I work for somebody, I just want to please them. I just want to make them at the end of the day go, well done, you did a really good job there. So I was never tired. And I remember it was in the days when you had unions in TV, especially the BBC, and I wanted to help them lift a cable. So I lifted a cable. My God, did I get told off by the cable back, don't you touch that cable, you're not in the union. I was like, I don't know why I'm talking about, I'm only trying to help. And that was it. And I loved it. I absolutely adored every second of it. I thought it was fantastic. And I just couldn't believe that I was here doing this thing. It was an incredible stage in my life, and my eyes were wide open. But my dad was always about, keep your feet on the ground, don't let any of this telly nonsense, you know, alter you keep your feet on the ground, you know. And he was right. And you know, I always remember that, and not that I needed to, because I think I've always been a sort of very down-to-earth person. You know, I'm not show busy at all. I can't stand show busy events, you know, or celebrity people, you know, that mwah, mwah, darling, it's just not me, you know, just not me. I'd rather be at home with my curlers in, bottle of wine and a bag of crisps. That's me all the way.
that's me, but without the rollers in the hair.
Oh, are you sure? You might look nice with them.
But yeah, I mean, was it just Sea View again? Was it filmed in Blackpool, or was it filmed elsewhere?
Yeah, so it was filmed in Blackpool on location, and then the first series, it was filmed at the BBC studios in Manchester, and sadly, they're no longer there anymore. They've knocked them down on Oxford Road. And then the second series was filmed in London. And I always remember how you had to have a tutor, and you had to have a, oh gosh, people that look after you, you know, I'm just trying to think of the word, not like a nanny. But,
yes, you know, I know. Yeah, like one. Yeah.
My brain's a bug today. Anyway, so, and it was always weird. I was always remember this. She was the first lady that we had to look after us. Everywhere we went, she used to take food off the plate, and she wouldn't eat it. She'd put it in this bag of hers, like a shoulder bag, but it was a material shoulder bag. And I remember being so grossed out, because everywhere we went, you could smell last night's dinner. But not only that, was like grease marks all over the bag. And I remember we went to the swimming pool, because when we were in Blackpool, we stayed in the Imperial Hotel, and she got into the swimming pool and she came up like that, and she had the biggest long chest hairs dangling down the front of her. And I was so, she was a lovely lady, but as a kid, I was really grossed out by her. And I think she had crossover toes as well, you know, the sandals, and they have crossover toes. And it,
yeah.
I was, yeah. So that was it. I can't remember her name now, but she was very nice. But kids at that age, you know, you just, little things really make you go, oh my God. And then there was another lady. She was really nice. She always had a fag in her mouth and loved to have vodka at the end of the night.
There's some great people for usage for characters moving forward, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely fantastic. And there were loads of characters on that. Marilyn Fox, the director, she always had a fag in her mouth. It was in the days when everybody smoked. And I think I had my first naughty fag, my first naughty cigarette in the hotel room. Because Chris Hargreaves, who went on to, he's done quite a few. I think he was in Coronation Street and stuff like that. And Aaron Brown, they played my brother and his best friend. And they were both smoking away. And I said, oh, I've never had a cigarette before. And they went, go on, have one, have one. And they shoved one in my mouth. And I went, what do I do with it? What do I do with it? Inhale, inhale. I was going, oh, God, nearly died. But subsequently after that, I would have a sneaky one without my mother knowing, especially when I was at college. I used to run my fingers through the hedge on the way home, so I hope the leaves would take the smell of the cigarette smoke away.
Things we used to do, eh?
Spray yourself with deodorant all over your hair. God, you don't smell the smoke. Have you been smoking? No, it's my friends on the bus. They've been smoking.
I read somewhere as well that you did have an appearance on Juliet Bravo, which again was one of those programs which I used to, you know, it's in the annals of history as like one of those programs which was really popular on the BBC back in the day. What can you remember what part you played?
Yeah, I played, funnily enough, it was, do you remember Ken Roach, who played Ken Barlow? It was his wife who played my mum, and wow. We'd been kidnapped and we had been held hostage inside the house. And Juliet Bravo and the police came to save us. And the end shot was, all it was just me at the end, just waving. I think that was all I can remember. I don't ever remember being tied to a chair or anything, but that was my big part in Juliet Bravo. I couldn't believe it. My God, I got a part in Juliet Bravo.
You know, hearing that story, I'm sure that when you've been on a program at one point being interviewed, I'm sure that clip was shown at some point. You might remember. I don't know. That seems to ring a bell with me. I'm sure I've seen it. Maybe I just saw the episode. Who knows? But moving forward to Blue Peter, and it's a bad photo alert, Yvette. Bad photo alert.
They're all bad photos. My God, look at the jumper under my hair. Oh my God.
I was thinking more of Mark Curry's shirt.
Oh, do you know, Mark Curry, one of the loveliest, loveliest men I've ever had the pleasure to work with. We're still in touch with each other, and he's just such a lovely person, you know. And it's very rare to meet people in television that are genuinely really lovely and caring. And Mark really helped me out within that first year, because I had a terrible time when I first joined, because I was only young. I was 18 years old, and I think I'd been abroad once with a friend. I think it was Val de Lobo in Portugal with a family thing. And that was it. And then the next thing I knew, before we started in the studio, I was whisked off to Russia, which was the USSR in those days, for 6 weeks. And Russia in 1987 was a hard place. It was really hard. I mean, there were queues everywhere for bread. There was the Inn Tourist Hotel, which was the only hotel where tourists could stay. You weren't allowed to stay anywhere else. And I remember being terrified, because on each floor, outside the lifts, were these what we call lift ladies. And they sat there in these sort of white coats and chef hats with walkie-talkies. And they would speak in Russian and tell whoever it was who was going in the lift, who was going out, what room number they were going into. It was really, really weird. And I remember once I got a knock on the door and I opened it, and a guy, a strange guy, had put his foot in the door and he just said in English, "I want your jeans. I want your jeans." And I'm pushing the door. Oh my God. And I managed to get him out. And I was really upset because, of course, they didn't have denim in Russia in 1987. And when they saw somebody wearing denim, oh my God, we're going to have that. But I did, there's a funny story. At the same time, there was a very famous film star, Hollywood film star, who was making a film in that area, and he was staying in that hotel. And me being very fashionable with my Kevin Keegan perm and the things that I was wearing at the time, a pair of very nice jeans with braces, a white T-shirt and badges of everywhere that we'd been in Russia on the front. And me and Karen Keating got into the lift. And Karen, being she could have looked fabulous in a bloody Waitrose carrier bag or an Aldi carrier. She looked amazing, anything she wore. And she was wearing something fabulous and her hair was all gorgeous, beautiful. And we get into this lift and my accent was more northern then than it is now. And we get in and there's this, we open the door on one floor and this smallish man gets in and he's wearing padded shoulders. I mean, he's really small. Honestly, he must have come up to here. I was really small. And padded shoulders with those 1980s where you push up, you know, sort of slightly silky blue jacket, Ray-Ban mirrored glasses, dark cropped hair. I'm talking to Karen and suddenly she stops looking at me. She stops talking to me and I'm like, and I'm saying him in a northern accent. I'm nudging her. And she's looking at this guy. And I'm going, "What's up with you? What's up with you? What's up with you? Speak to me. What's the matter?" And she's nudging me back going like this. What? Anyway, this conversation keeps going. He gets out the lift, the doors close, and she turns around to me. "That was fucking Tom Cruise, you idiot." And it was Tom Cruise. And there's me giving it Kevin Keegan perm, northern accent, not knowing at all who it was. But yeah, it was Tom Cruise in the lift. That's one of my claims to fame.
That's a classic. And again, this is another similarity because I went to Russia in 1988 for two weeks, stayed at the same hotel. I was performing Oliver Twist out there playing the Artful Dodger for 2 weeks as part of a touring stage play. And I remember those exact cues. My nightmare Russia story was that egg on a morning. We got a soft boiled egg. For dinner, we got grated egg as part of a salad for dinner. And in the evening, guess what we got? Egg. Again. Egg again, but this time in soup. I've never had egg in soup ever.
I've been bound up for months, weren't you? Years.
Dear me. Well, put it this way. I lost weight when I was across there because the food was horrendous. I ate bread and I had water, but it was horrendous. We did the overnight train from Moscow to Leningrad.
We did that. With the tea lady.
And I discovered, that was when I discovered brown vodka. And I was only 16. So I was given a shot of this brown vodka and told to drink it quickly, which I did. And you can't savour it because it burns. So it hit straight at the back of my throat. And, yeah, it really did burn. And then I had my second one, part of one in my eye. So for the rest of the train journey, I'm trying to dab it with water.
Oh, my God.
My eye was running constantly for about 2.5-3 hours on that train, the overnight train. But fascinating place. And it's somewhere, obviously not at the moment, but I would love to have gone back to just to see the difference of Russia, you know, in 88 to what it is now. It's a fascinating place. But we had a similar thing with the denim as well, the jeans. It was fascinating. And I mean, there was people on the streets trading little badges as well, trying to sell you little, but I've still got a few of those somewhere in a drawer somewhere, I think. But amazing place, Yvette. Amazing place. I feel privileged to have at least gone there anyway.
Yeah, me too. So, So I did that and then came back and then it was, right, you're going live. Well, of course, being an actress, as you know, not you being an actress, you're an actor. you're trained, you don't look at the camera, you ignore it. It's not there, it's not in the room, you're just getting on with your business. So that's what I've been, you know, for years been taught to do. And then lo and behold, and you're going to look right into this camera now with a big red light on the top and you're live. I'd had no training, nothing. Well, I'd see that red light go on. I'd say the first couple of sentences and then I'd freeze. It was awful. And I had terrible nerves. There was no auto cue in those days. There was no earpieces. There was nothing. You know, like you watch them on This Morning or whatever show you're watching and you can see them reading the auto cue, can't you?
Yeah.
And it's sad, really, because, you know, you lose that interaction. But anyway, I and it was awful because you'd have to learn the script. And then the editor at the time, Biddy Baxter, she'd come down just before live on air. She'd put a big red mark right through your script. Darlings, I've rewritten your bit. What? I've got literally 20 minutes or whatever it was to learn this new stuff and which camera to look into. I found it very, very, very hard. And, you know, at first, Karen was busy doing her stuff, but it was Mark that took me under his wing and really, really helped me. And I didn't get any support from anybody else at the BBC. I just got support from Mark. And later on, Karen also really helped me. You know, she was lovely as well. So I was very lucky to have Mark and Karen sort of bring me on, really, and give me that confidence. And then I had, then it was another 4 years, Biddy left, and then my confidence grew, and that was it. I was off, you know, and I loved it. It was great.
Yeah, I mean, Biddy Baxter as well, it's a name that becomes, it's world-renowned to anybody who watched Blue Preacher, but it's interesting to hear some stories about that. Yeah, you also had a moment in a roller coaster on Blue Preacher.
Yes, apparently it's been voted the most popular item on Blue Peter, which made me laugh because I thought surely it'd be the elephant pooing and John Noble looking at it. I mean, that's my favourite. But yeah, it was the longest. It was when the revolution at Blackpool first came out. And they sent us there. And we did the going forward and I screamed all the way round. I don't know if I think I just did it in two breaths. And then I don't know how I managed to do it. To make the machine work, the ride work, you have to use a key. Well, I managed to get the key out of the console and put it in my bra. And I said, we're not going backwards. I said, we're not going backwards. And they laughed so much and they knew they could tell that I was like, ugh. And they said, all right, we've got the shot. We've got what we needed. And it became very famous, that shot. Little did I know I was going to become famous for my screaming.
Was there any other moments on Blue Peter that you either cherish or you think, oh, you know, I just didn't really want to do that? Is there any that you can think of?
Oh, there's loads. One of my favourite moments is training to fly a Seeking helicopter with the Navy at HMS Cold Rose in Cornwall, and that was absolutely amazing to me because I flew and passed the simulator test, and then once I'd done that, they then said, you can fly a real Seeking. So I was kitted up with all the gear. I was taken out. I was sat at the front with the captain. And he said, Miss Fielding, you now have full control. And I flew it, obviously, in a straight line. I didn't go up, down or anything. But it was just marvellous to hear that. And I said, have I really? Because I thought he's just saying that. And he went, no, you have full control of this helicopter. And I've got pictures framed of me when I first come out of the helicopter and my face is just flushed and I'm just so over the moon. And then the other one is going down the bobsleigh run in Germany with the British bobsleigh team. That was, for your sports fans, that was hilarious because I got the phone call and they said, look, would you like to, you know, go bobsleighing? And I'd kind of seen it, but I just thought it was like on flat and there was a little bit of a slope and that was it. Yeah, God, I'd love that. Turn up in Germany and that night I met Nick Phipps and the team and they said, right, let's go and walk the course. Well, of course, I took one look at it. God's bloody hell, it's a massive sodding mountain. It looked like a Mr. Whippy with a track going around it like that. And then we had to walk this course. Of course, we had to get like a ski lift up to the top or something. And I'm looking down, absolutely shitting myself. And we get to the top and we walk it. And you can see where the bobsleighs have gone up and careered off the top. You can see the marks. Oh, yes, people have been injured. Some have even died, they're saying to me. I'm like, are you kidding me? No, you all right? You're nervous? Yeah. following morning, didn't sleep that night, following morning, the most embarrassing situation, you have to wear full body lycra. Come on. Well, you can see what everyone's packing, including the girls. It's not a good look. Let me tell you, you could see what I'd have for lunch. It was awful. So there I am, being a Blue Peter presenter, pretending everything's okay. You can see everything. Anyway, get me in the bobsleigh as quick as you can because I'm so embarrassed. So they put me in this bobsleigh. I'm sitting in there first. And the other guy say, we'll push. We'll start it all off. You just stay sitting. Well, there's steering at the front. It's very, very, very basic. Steering at the front. And then there's a brake at the back. That's it. And then a handle flips out at the side. And then they start pushing backwards and forwards. You wait for the light and off you go. Well, it started off quite slow, and then lo and behold, it's got faster and faster and faster, and we're whipping round to the point where I can't lift my head up because the G-force was so powerful. And the only thing I could think of to say, I've got my radio mic on, I'd watched the Three Amigos like a few nights before, and I don't know if you've ever seen Steve Martin's in it, and they do this ridiculous dance routine while singing My Little Buttercup. So as I'm going down this bobsleigh with the British bobsleigh team, I'm actually singing My Little Buttercup has the sweetest smile as I'm going round, shakily, obviously. Anyway, we do the thing. They said, would you go back up and do it again? We need another shot. And I literally, my neck was killing me. And I just went, I can't do another one. I said, that was bad enough doing the first one. The director, Nick Heathcote, who was like 6 foot wide and 6 foot tall, said, well, I'll have to put the lycra on and double up as you. And if you watch that footage, the wide shot is a big fat version of me going down this thing. Anyway, they got the shots everything was shot on film back then. So of course in the hotel room we're watching the rushes, and they go, Yvette, we can't use the sound. We cannot use the sound with you singing My Little Buttercup. We're going to have to redo the sound. So I said, well, I'm not going back down on that thing again. So the following, that morning, we're in the hotel and we go into the car park and they sit me in a car. The director sat behind me, Big Nick Heathcote. The PA sat on the other side. And there's some guys at the back. And they said, right, we're going to start shaking the car. I'm fixed with my microphone. The sound guy's outside the car with his earphones on. They start shaking the car, shaking the car, shaking the car. And I've got to pretend I'm going round, you see. Well, as I'm going, we're coming to the first bend now. This is incredible. Oh, God, I can't lift my head. The G-force is incredible. The steam is going in the car. All the windows are steamed up. The car's shaking from side to side. There's a guy standing outside with earphones. And the police were called. The police came in because the hoteliers thought that we were filming some sort of sexy, weird porn movie. Anyway, so if you ever watch that clip on YouTube, that's what happened. There you go.
That's brilliant. That's a great story. Where do you go from that? Well, you go to ITV, which is a big move for you because it introduced you to an adult audience and doing another presenting role, but this time on a program called What's Up Doc, which I can just about remember was a children's ITV show. What was that like going from the, you know, Blue Peter, which I've always felt was, you know, very BBC to ITV, which at that moment was starting to get a little bit more wacky on a Saturday morning.
Yeah, it was wonderful because for the first time ever, there were these two producers, Jed Allen and Vanessa Hill. They're married now. It was incredible because for the first time ever, we were allowed to have a creative input. So we'd sit in the meeting and they'd say, well, will you do this? And we'd say, of course, da, da, da. Oh, that's really funny. And I'd go, well, what if I did this? What if I did, love that, let's put it in the script. Da, da, da. And that never happened before on Blue Peter. So all of a sudden, I felt really part of a creative team. And it got my creative juices flowing, and it's one of the best TV shows I've ever done. And talk about laugh. Oh my God. Laugh, laugh, laugh every weekend, just tears streaming down our faces. There was one character in there. He was called Simon Perry, and he was dressed up like a cyclist with a cagoule, and he had his sort of like reflective strip across him, and he had great big ears. And what he used to do was the guy who played him used to rub himself in Gorgonzola cheese in the dressing room, so he really stank. And then he'd have like a fake cockerel, like a bird shoved under his arm. And then he'd walk around and he'd like to Kylie Minogue, and he had a voice like that. So he said, "Oh, hello, Kylie, Simon Perry here. Would you like to stroke my cock?" And it was like, no, oh my God. And we had loads of complaints from Ofcom. But of course, all the parents loved it, but it went over the kids' heads. You know, it was so funny and so double entendre, and I loved it. It was one of the, and those two producers, Vanessa and Jed, they were the best producers I've ever worked with. So lovely and kind. And, you know, it's very rare to get people like that, you know, as you know, when you work in TV, to find real gems like that. And I was very, very lucky to work with them. They were fantastic. And sadly, like all things, good things, it came to an end, and Scottish TV took it to Scotland. I did, I think, the penultimate year before it was taken off air. That was sad when that ended, you know. And I had a bit of a break to bring up my son, and then moved on to other things.
Now, the other children's TV program which we have in common, Biker Grove.
Now, you see, this is a misconception, and it's I was never on Biker Grove.
This is one of those infamous showbiz stories which is leaked out there, which isn't true. Why do you think that's come about then?
I have no idea. I remember, you know, everybody at some point is going to go on Wikipedia and go, "Oh, what does this say?" And I'm going, "Biker Grove. I've never been on Biker Grove." And it actually says, plays the character, I think it's Sam on Biker Grove. I have no idea who that is. And either that, or I've got really bad Alzheimer's and I can't even remember that. I have no idea.
Would you have liked to have been on Biker Grove? Well, you're a northern lass.
I was, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have, at the time when I was a teenager, I wouldn't have said no. Biker Grove. I love, you know.
You've got the accent.
I love your accent. And I don't know if I'm very good at it. I think it's a little bit, you know, stilted. But my mum used to have a best friend called Sheila, and she was down the road. She was from Newcastle. She had these really long brown cigarettes. And whenever the sun was out, she was in it. She looked brown, like a piece of leather. And yeah, she'd be there, and she'd come and, "Yvette, come here, pet. Oh, you're a canny bean, you are. You're a canny bean. Oh, you're lovely, you are, Yvette." And I always remember Sheila. She was from Newcastle, obviously, and she was just lovely. And that was my love of the Newcastle accent. And sadly, I've only been a couple of times. So I'd love to go again.
Yeah, I'm sure you will be back soon. One thing we know is true is stars in their eyes. Now, this is a blast from the past, isn't it? Because this used to be Saturday Night TV at its very best before Ant and Dec came and monopolised ITV's hours, and Simon Cowell with all of his reality programmes. But you came onto Stars and Rise and did Annie Lennox.
I did. I'm laughing because I remember the fear.
So Annie Lennox, are you a big fan?
Oh, I love Annie Lennox. I wanted to do, I said to them, "I'd love to do it." I said, "And I'd love to do Annie Lennox." And I said, "Please, can I do Sweet Dreams?" And they went, "No, been there and done that. We're not doing Sweet Dreams." I said, "Please don't give me anything slow or anything with high notes in it." So we'll come to the studios and we'll have a plinky plonky on the piano and see what you can do. Anyway, I sang, "But just try No More, I Love You." "No, it's slower." "Oh, no, just try it." So I tried it. They went, "That's what you're doing." I went, no. I cried on the way home. "I'm doing those No More, I Love Yous. Oh, God, none of it makes sense to me, the words and everything. It's just so funny." And when I actually did it, they had to push me up the ramp to get, because I was so nervous. And then you have two takes at it, and right at the very end all these petals came falling down, and I'm going like that. One of the petals went right down the back of my throat, and I went and I started going, "Oh, bloody hell," like that. Unfortunately, they gave me take two, which is there you go. And I said, and they gave me, which is something they did, they don't normally do, but I got very friendly with the wardrobe people. It was so creative and wonderful. And I was asking them all about the outfit. And the necklace there, they said the jewels on that were worn by Dame Margot Fontaine in a ballet. And they gave me everything. They gave me the whole kit and caboodle of that outfit, and I have it all boxed up under the bed. I have such great memories of that. And my granddad, of the footage, who's sadly no longer with us, my granddad is in the audience watching, and he looks ever so proud. And it was a wonderful moment, and I'm very proud of that, because I thought, oh my God. And there was no auto-tune or anything. And I thought, oh God, can I do it? And I practiced for months, you know, and I think I just about pulled it off, which was okay. I got a review in one of the newspapers going, yes, not a bad attempt. I thought, that's good. Thank God it's not slating me.
Was that in the years of Matthew Kelly doing it? Was it
It was Cat Deeley. Cat Deeley.
Wow, yeah. There's another name from the past, isn't there? Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. Okay, good stuff. There's not many more surprises. don't worry about that. I've got to ask, is this a lie that you did Celebrity Mastermind?
Yeah, I've done it twice, but I like to keep it. I like to keep that hidden because I was so shockingly bad.
What were your subjects?
Well, the first time I did it was Henry VIII, and I think I kept, which was quite good actually, because I didn't come last. I think I came third, which was good. And then recently, it aired, I think, in September, and all my friends were going, "Oh, you're on Mastermind!" And my chosen subject was Morecambe and Wise, massive Morecambe and Wise fan. And I came second in that round, and I did the boys proud. But then when it came to general knowledge, everything that came out of his mouth, it just went in and out. And I actually started laughing and making nonsense up. So I came last. And all my friends were texting me, going, you're on Mastermind. I was going, don't watch it. Don't watch it. It's embarrassing. Please don't watch it.
It takes guts to go on there. I think there'd be something quite nerve-wracking about going into that black chair under the spotlight.
Yeah, and you've got to know. And they send you a book or a DVD, and you have to learn the whole of that book. You have to learn it all, because you don't know where those 10 questions or how many questions you get in the buzzer, in the time. You don't know what they're going to ask you anything. So, of course, I learned the whole book. And my poor husband, he was like a coach, you know, right, and my daughter, right, come on, let's go from the beginning. What year were they born? What year did they first get together? Who were they married to? Where, what was the mother called? And loads of stuff like that, you know, and who was the manager? And I learned so much stuff. And in the end, they only asked me a couple of questions that were, you know, that were relatable. The other ones were sort of like odd questions that I kind of guessed and got right. So it was very strange. Yeah, it's a lot of hard work and nerve-wracking when you hear that music.
Oh, definitely, I can imagine. Yeah, okay, good stuff. Paranormal Activity then is something else which I think some of our viewers will recognize you immediately from. Some people will be surprised to hear a lot of those backstories, but the paranormal stuff, where did that come from? Where did the interest stem from?
Well, I've always been interested in the paranormal. I mean, from being a kid, there was a couple of programs on Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World that I used to absolutely love. And then there was another program with starring Michael Aspel called Strange But True, which I adored. But sometimes I got a bit spooked and wouldn't watch it. But I also remember my mum, she got the magazine. It used to come out with a monthly Arthur C. Clarke, and inside was sort of like a little floppy vinyl disc that you could throw away.
Yes.
Yeah, do you remember those? And yes. It was Voices from the Dead. And so my mum put it on the record player, and it's right in the house. And we were both hiding. I think it was about 8 or 9, both hiding behind the door, and my mum trying to reach over to rip it off the record player. And then she just threw it in the bed. She went, we're never having that again. But that, my interest in it, even though I was scared, it was there. It was in the back of my head. And years later, I met my husband, Carl, and a friend of ours came over to our house on a Sunday, and he said he'd been to this amazing place called Michelin Priory. He said, and if you ever want to film there, guys, you know, because my husband, Carl, was a cameraman. I was a jobbing presenter at the time. If you hear of anybody that wants to use a location, Michelin Priory in in Sussex is absolutely amazing. Oh, and it's got 13 ghosts. And we don't know why still to this day. But Carl, after our friend had left, Carl looked at me and he went, would you spend the night in a haunted house with a camera crew? And I'd watched Blair Witch like a month before. And I went, oh, I said, yes. I said, we could use those night vision cameras. And then we spent the rest of the night sitting there writing up the idea of Most Haunted. And we gave it the worst title ever, which was called Yvette, was it? Yvette Fielding's Haunting Truths. So obviously that got axed. And yeah, we tried to sell it to every single channel that was available and nobody wanted it. Channel 5 even said that we were unprofessional for filming this kind of genre. And, you know, and we were like, what? Yeah, but nobody wanted it. Nobody wanted it. And it was heartbreaking because we worked so hard and spent all of our savings, all of our hard-earned money on making this pilot program that we really, I don't know what it was. It was like we're possessed. You know, we wanted to get this out and we had it professionally edited. It looked fantastic. It looked great. The pilot was wonderful. And it was purely just a friend of a friend that said, well, why don't you take it to Arch Dyson? He said, who's the head of Flextech Media at the time. He said, and down in Maidstone, he said, go and take it to him. He's in charge of all these channels. He'll tell you what's wrong with it. So Carl was working down there as a cameraman on a game show called Defectors. And he said, oh, Arch, could I have some moment, you know, a minute with you? He said, I want to show this pilot. And it was a VHS at the time. And Arch sat there and he went, yeah, of course, put the tape in. Watch the whole thing. Never said a damn thing. Carl thought, oh, he thinks it's shit. He thinks it's awful. Anyway, it finished. He took the VHS out, tapped his fingers on top of the VHS and he said, I'll have that. He said, it'll go on a new channel of ours. He said, it's nearly, it hasn't got any viewing figures. It's doing very badly. And this just might be the thing to save it, which of course was Living TV at the time. And he said, I'd like 16 of them. And that was it. The show was born and it ran. It's well, gosh. And funnily enough, Sky have just bought all the back catalogue. So all the new ones that we've just made, they've all gone on to Sky, which is wonderful for us. And STV as well. And Pluto, it's been sold to over 100 territories around the world. So from someone that, a couple that just didn't get anywhere and were heartbroken, I mean, in tears because we couldn't sell this idea. You know, for me, I always say to people, if you really believe in something and it's your dream, you just got to keep going, because if you really believe it, it will happen and you'll get your project, whatever it is, off the ground. You've just got to keep going. And that's what we did. Yeah.
Yeah. Great, great example to anybody out there who, you know, wants to, you know, wants an idea out. It's the best advice anybody can give of keep going, you know, because in this industry, the stuff that we've talked about already, you get plenty knockbacks, don't you?
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. Heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking. And you know, it's you get to that stage when you're in the media, I think, well, for me anyway, I think it was in my 40s, where you're still thinking, well, where's my next job coming from? Where's my next TV thing? Am I doing enough? Am I getting enough exposure? Am I this? Have I got the right agent? I'm all of that. And then one day I just thought, hang on a minute, I'm fine, doing all right. Absolutely fine. Do you know, put all your memories, everything that you have done, into a box, label it, put tape over it, put it in the bottom of your wardrobe and go, that's my career. And what a fantastic career it's been. I don't need any more. And to be able to have that power to be able to say, I don't need it anymore, I think is it's been a very cathartic thing for me to have gone through. And I feel very sorry for people that are the same age as me or older and they're still chasing it. They're still chasing being on the television and going to the opening of an envelope. And I think that's really sad. And I think, oh, don't chase fame, because fame is wonderful, but it can also be the devil. It can be really evil and it can mess with your head, you know?
Yeah, it takes a certain person really to have that kind of attitude. In fact, I admire you for it, and it's a great quality to have. You know, I've got to be honest. It's the paranormal stuff's always fascinated me. I do believe in life after death. I do believe in ghosts. Is there a time that you've done one of these programs where you have come away feeling particularly uneasy? Is the one which stands out? Because, you know, people can laugh at these programs and people can say, well, it's TV, it's entertainment, it's not real. But, you know, I've spoken to Alan Robson up here many times, who is probably, you know, well known in this area for doing very similar things, staying at Chillingham Castle, etc., and doing live broadcasts from places. But what's the one that stands out which left you feeling particularly uncomfortable?
I think the very first time that I watched three crew members get physically hurt, that really shocked me because I didn't think that that was possible whatsoever. And it was in Edinburgh Vaults, and we were broadcasting live across the United Kingdom, but also live across America on Discovery. So we had various cameras all over the place taking all these different shots. And there's a stone circle in one of the rooms, and allegedly it was put there by witches. And one of the reasons why we decided to do that was because tourists that were doing tours round Edinburgh Vaults were actually complaining to the tour operator saying, I've got scratches all on my arms. You know, what's going on here? I walked through that stone circle and this has happened to me. So we thought, well, that's interesting. Let's see if we can get something here. And one of the tour operators said, whatever you do, don't stand in the center of the stone circle and don't be disrespectful. If you do, or God knows what will happen to you. So three members of the team, Carl, Stewart and John, the sound guy, decided they were going to do exactly that. So just before we go live, they stand in the circle, they're effing and jeffing and being very disrespectful. And we go live. Now, Stewart's got one camera. He's got his part of his back. So the US camera is picking him up. He's got a black leather jacket on and a white T-shirt underneath. Carl is stood in the center of the circle getting other shots, and John is standing at the back with his back against the wall. We're all in shot. There's loads of cameras. And all of a sudden, Stuart just screams, Yvette, my back is burning. It's burning. Get my coat off. So bearing in mind, again, the shot is he's in shot. So I pull his black leather jacket off, and you can see started to come through his white T-shirt blood. We pull his T-shirt off, and he's still got the scars today. Three massive scratches right from the top of his right shoulder right down to his top of his left buttock. It's like Freddy Krueger had just gone to town. And I was so shocked. I'd never seen anything like it before in my life. Then Carl, the back of his neck, three scratches on the back of his neck, not as deep as Stuart's, but they were definitely there. And then the worst bit came. John Gilbert, the sound guy, he falls to the floor screaming in agony, clutching at his leg. From the side of his leg, below his knee, just below his knee, down to his ankle, top of his ankle, is a cut so deep you could see the bone. And we had to call paramedics. This is all happening live on air. Paramedics, he's taken out, and he goes off to Accidents Emergency, where he's stitched up. I have to somehow keep this show on air. I keep breaking down in tears. You can watch it. It's on YouTube. I'm breaking down in tears. I've got to keep myself together. But I'm so shocked because this is the first time that they can harm you. They can cut you. They can. And I resigned on air. I actually said, I can't do this anymore. I don't understand what's going on. This is so frightening to me. And anyway, the show finished and we got fans in Scotland coming to the hotel and leaving flowers at reception. We please don't leave. And then the channel, what the hell's going on? You can't resign. We need you to carry on. Anyway, that night, all the crew, we sat up in our in a hotel room and we just analysed it and kept going through it and talking about it and talking about it. And John came back from accident emergency with stitches and all. Oh, my God. It was just horrific, absolutely horrific. And I took, a good couple of weeks off, 3 weeks off. And then I suddenly thought, I'm not going to let this beat me. I need to find out more about it. So then I started looking into real cases of where these scratches and burns were occurring, because burns then happened later on in Most Haunted, and that was awful as well. But the scratches, so for instance, in the real case of The Exorcist, it was a little boy rather than a little girl. He was getting scratches on his torso with words and so on. Lots of these cases that have been made into Hollywood movies were taken from real cases, and the scratches do appear and they are real in real cases. And that really shocked me, but it really intrigued me. And then I got this, I'm not going to let this get the better of me. I'm going to find out more about this. This is interesting. So then I just I don't know what happened. I just found this new bravery and I just thought, you can stuff off, you're not going to stop me. And then we continued. And then the next time was at East Drive. That was carving knives at dawn and burns. Just horrific. horrific. And I sat in the car after that one, just crying my eyes out, saying the Lord's Prayer over and over and over and over again. There was another time when we went to Transylvania. We went to Corvin Castle, which is where Vlad Tepes, Vlad the Impaler, that's where he, it was his childhood home for a certain amount of time. And the villagers in the cellar of Corvin Castle, there's a big hole, and they sort of covered most of it over, and they call it the mouth to hell, because they believe that, they really do believe that you don't go near there. Some awful things have happened in that castle. So me and my stupidity went, let's do a Ouija board live on air over the mouth to hell. Be fine. Anyway, we came back from Transylvania. Oh, that's right. One of the riggers got pushed down a hole outside, broke his leg. And when we spoke to him, he said, well, there was someone in costume, in like a monk's costume. He said, he just pushed me in. And we went, we haven't got anybody in a monk's costume. It's a closed set. No one could. And he never found out who it was. That was awful. But when we came home, every member of the crew had something awful happen to them. Wow. I had a crazy accident on a horse where I'm just going down the road. This horse is as placid as anything. And it was weird. It was like somebody was standing in front of it and doing this. It reared up and went backwards. I managed to get off the saddle, but it fell backwards. Fortunately, it didn't injure itself, and I wasn't injured. And fortunately, there were no cars on this country road, but it could have been a lot different. Family members died. People went bankrupt. Animals died. Everybody was affected, so much so we went to the church and got blessed. And the vicar looked at me and he went, promise me you won't be doing any of these Ouija boards or any of these paranormal investigations ever again. And I felt terrible because I lied.
Wow, amazing. Catch up with some of those stuff on YouTube. I'm sure there will be some great ones to watch. Yeah. I've got to talk about this. it fascinates me, the jungle. It really does. I think it's become, especially when you've got kids, mine are slightly older now, but you know, you love to sit and watch it, and the build up to Christmas. There's something great about watching celebrities eat different parts of animals, yeah, and happenings, I guess, oh, and squirming. What was your experience like? I mean, the people you went in with, I mean, a couple of Geordie connections there. Vicky Patterson, a good friend of mine, who won it, of course.
Yes.
Kieran Dyer, a former footballer of these parts. Yes. Duncan Bannantyne, another guy who has connections to the Northeast and has gyms up this neck of the woods. And somebody who I've worked with in the past, who's certainly a funny guy, Chris Eubank.
I remember doing a sparring thing with him.
Yeah.
I said, come on, Chris, show me how to spar. And he did. He's right, come on. I thought, oh my God, I'm sparring with Chris Eubank. And we got on really well. We got on very, very well. I got on very well with Duncan Bannantyne, really well. And we looked out for each other very much so. He was a really lovely man. And of course, there was the infamous Lady C.
Just
a character, shall we say. Just a very difficult person to get on with. Once she made her mind up about not doing something, she didn't do it. And the production team obviously liked putting me and her together, because I was just like, oh my God, because every time I wanted to prove myself, she'd say, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. And I'm like, come on, we can show how good we are. No, I'm not doing that. And I'm like, oh my God. So that was really frustrating. And I made my opinions well known on the television about what I thought about her.
You did.
Yeah, she did drive me nuts, you know, but I wasn't the only one. I think she drove most of the people in the camp nuts.
Did you enjoy it? I mean, and would you, you know, did were you a bit gutted? You went out, you know, I think you went out.
No, I couldn't wait to leave
to get to that hotel that everybody goes to.
I couldn't wait to leave. Because I think it was just, I love the people there apart from Lady C. We all got on really, really well. But I was finding it hard, because what you don't see is it's just so much hanging around, and the worst bit was, and you've got to drink a shake now, Yvette. Oh, what's this made out of? Oh, triantula. Okay. And I remember drinking this shake, and the hairs from the triantula was sticking in the back of my throat. I tried to make myself sick so many times to get it, and I couldn't get it up because there was nothing in my stomach, because we were so hungry. We were starving. And I lost, I think it's a stone and a half, which was fantastic. That was it. What you don't see is they've got speakers in the camp, and there's all these people that wear camouflage gear all around the outer camp, and they're stopping anything dangerous from getting in the camp, any critters getting in there. And they're all sort of like camouflaged up, you know? And they said, if there's a problem, if a creature gets in that shouldn't be in there, you will hear through the speakers, celebrities get on your beds, and that's what you must do. Well, one of the guys, Brian, his name was, and he was an American chap, a choreographer that had done Britney Spears videos and stuff like that. He was a really nice guy. We were all woken up at 5 o'clock in the morning with him screaming because a snake had got into his sleeping bag. Celebrities on your beds, celebrities on your beds. So we'll jump on the beds. And then these guys come in like flipping SAS ninja warriors. And they come in with these long snake sticks and a sack. And we're all stood there going, oh my God. And they managed to get the snake. There was another one, the Black Widow spider had got in. It's like, oh my God. So I made myself like this little cubby thing where I'd put my cover over the top of my head, and I'd make myself a breathing hole and tuck everything in. And you know, for weeks, I think it must have been about a month afterwards, I couldn't sleep normally. I had to have the duvet over me with a little breathing hole. And I can't remember who else it was, but someone said that they couldn't sleep on a normal bed. They had to sleep on the floor because they'd got so used to that way. It was an incredible adventure and one I'll never, ever forget. I just wish we hadn't had Lady C in, because I think it would have made my experience better. And I think I would have wanted to stay longer. She ruined it for me. And that was one of the main reasons why I wanted to leave, because she was just like this black cloud that hung over and made the atmosphere just so difficult for everybody. You know, and people were in bad moods, and Tony from Spandau Ballet, I mean, she really got on his nerves, and Duncan, you know, these two lovely men, you know, were just absolutely furious, you know, with her. And you could sense that the atmosphere was awful. So I just couldn't wait to leave, because I cannot stand being around anybody that's negative. I'll walk out of a room, I'll just make an excuse and go. I just can't stand that. I think it's really, really bad for you as a person.
A vexation to the spirit, we'll call it. We'll say that. which is quite apt for paranormal activities. The writing side of things is what we're going to finish. And yes, obviously a few paranormal books, you know, your most haunted books, etc., coming out. But then you recently your first novels, you know, back in 2019, Archie the Ghost Hunter and The Rising, which were published. I think it was, did Carl do the illustrations for those books?
Yeah, I did. It was a family affair.
And then Anderson Press have published the new series of books, The Ghost Hunter Chronicles, and I've uploaded the covers for those particular books, which people can go and seek out on Amazon or any good bookshops, Waterstones, yeah, and WH Smith's, you name it. You can go and get these books here. So you've got House in the Woods, you've got The Ripper of Whitechapel, and we have The Witches of Pendle. So tell us a little bit about the books and why you decided to move into that kind of angle. Is that something you always wanted to do? Was it part of the creative, you know, vibe inside you?
I think so, yeah. I mean, at school I was absolutely rubbish at writing, but we've been doing this thing called Most Haunted Experience for a few years now, where anybody can go on the website mosthauntedexperience.com, and there's all these haunted locations, and you can join me and the Most Haunted team. And we started that out because we wanted to show everybody that it's not fake. Like you were saying at the beginning, it's a TV show, you know, is it real? Isn't it real? So we wanted to show everybody, well, come along and experience it for yourself. And that's what we've done. And we've been doing it for a number of years, and we did an under 16s. And they were sold out. We did a couple, and it was absolutely fantastic, because I got the chance to meet these young ghost hunters. And they were the ones that said, a couple of them said, are you going to write a book about it so you can scare us? And that's what gave me the idea. I was just like, yeah, oh my God, why don't I try that? I'd already written Archie, I'd given that a go. And then I went to Anderson Press and said, what do you think? And they just said, yes, absolutely. And so I came up with the idea of, three 13-year-olds who were into the paranormal, and it's Halloween, the first book, and they just say, right, I've got a Ouija board off the internet. Let's be daring. Let's go and find a haunted house. And they find this house in the middle of Epping Forest, an abandoned old gamekeeper's house. And they do a Ouija board and something connects with them but follows them home. And so they have them and their families, you know, sort of have this horrific encounter with something. But actually it turns out that this thing that's attached themselves to them needs help. So there's this wonderful story that unfolds about this ghost. Then the Ripper of Whitechapel is obviously about the ghost of Jack the Ripper. And in each of the books, I use my own experiences with the paranormal. So, any paranormal activity that the three heroes come across, it's actual real phenomena that I've experienced myself, which I think is quite important, because I think write what you know about and what you love. So that's what I've done. And the Ripper of Whitechapel is about a school in Whitechapel. And it's built on the site where one of Jack the Ripper's victims was killed. But also there were two children that he kidnapped and he murdered. And so these two children are haunting this school. And Jack the Ripper is on the hunt to get these two kids because they're the only ones that know of his true identity, because they're the only ones that really saw his face. So our three heroes have to go to the school. And of course, all of this is under the guidance of Professor Pepper, which is Eve's uncle, who's Uncle Rufus. He helps them. And secretly, he's a member of the SPI, which is the Society of Paranormal Investigations, which is a secret underground organisation. Which is detecting and hunting ghosts and hauntings that are beginning to ramp up and plague the whole world. And then the Witches of Pendle, again, taken from my own experiences of a very famous live Most Haunted, which happened in Pendle, where all the crew ended up collapsed, strangled. And again, the paramedics had to come out. Really was the most terrifying incident I'd ever had, the first one really, before Edinburgh and East Drive. And I remember sitting there doing a Ouija board in one of the cottages where the alleged ghost of one of the Pendle witches lived. And I heard this squeaking noise. I thought, what the hell's that? As I'm sat at the table and I look underneath and I can see the screws coming undone from the table on their own. And the whole table just collapses. Oh my God, we caught a woman cackling and laughing. And then everybody, the camera crew, the lighting, the cable bashers, they all started feeling this pressure on their windpipe and they were collapsing. And the accident emergency were called and they were all being given oxygen to revive them. Again, that was a really frightening experience. So, of course, I use that as the main paranormal phenomena that occurs in this book, where these poor victims who are ancestors of the people that judged and hanged the real Pendle witches. So their ghosts have risen, come back, and they're taking revenge and they're trying to strangle and they possess people. And yeah, the third one is a lot darker than the first. We've moved on. It's getting a bit darker and darker. And I'm just starting to write the fourth one, which is all about the rise of Vlad the Impaler. And it's going to be based in Whitby. So I'm looking forward to getting my head into that one as well. And I'm
when do you expect that to come out, Eva?
That won't be until October 2024, I think. So because I've got another book to write, which is it's called Most Haunted Theatres. That comes out in October this year as well. So it's all my experiences with the Most Haunted crew investigating all the theatres. Of course, the most famous being the Grey Man in the theatre, Drury Lane. Royal Theatre, and that was an incredible experience. So talking about all these different theatres, and then I've got to write Most Haunted Castles, which will be the next one. So I'm just enjoying my life as a writer at the minute. I'm really getting a lot out of it. It's quite a lonely experience because you have to lock yourself away in a room. And I've found it's quite a fattening experience as well, because all I do is graze. It's just eating constantly.
Well, you look great today.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you very much. You need your thicker glasses on, love.
Honestly, it's been fantastic to spend just over an hour with you, Yvette. I mean, we know each other anyway, but it's just great to get to get a little insight into your career. And I think the message that people will take from this is that don't give up on your dreams, and you have to work hard. You do have to work hard to get to where you want to be, and there will be some pitfalls along the way, but just keep pushing away and keep trying.
That's exactly right. And just to end on the fact that with the paranormal note, there is life after death. I absolutely 100% can guarantee, I've heard enough, I've seen enough in 25 years to know that there is life after death. And your loved ones are always with you. They can see you and they can hear you. So have faith in that.
Fantastic. Great message there at the end. Don't forget, you can get any of Yvette's books on Amazon or any good bookshops, Waterstones, WH Smiths, wherever. And if you want to find out more about the paranormal, mosthauntedexperience.com is the website to visit. And it's just down there for you to take in. Now, Yvette, been an absolute pleasure. Look forward to catching up with you very soon. For now, Yvette Fielden, thanks very much.
It's been an honour. Thank you so much.
A big thanks to all our sponsors, Skips and Bins, telephone 0800 2545 253, email inquiries at skipsandbins.com, website skipsandbins.com, easy contract free and pay-as-you-go waste collection. Thanks to Mr. Vicky's Sauces, which are handmade in Cumbria. Their website is mrvickys.co.uk. If you want to contact the guys, email info@mrvickys.co.uk or telephone 01768 210102. Big thanks to New Workwear. They are an agile and dedicated workwear provider launched in 2018. For more information, go to their website, newworkwear.com. Big thanks, as always, to Media Arts for the help with the video side of things. If you want to support the channel, hit the subscribe button, become a subscriber today. Hit the thumb up under the video, which likes the video, and click share to share to your other social media. Click join if you want to become a member of the channel for as little as $1.99. Or take a one-off payment for the cult membership. You can get in via this QR code if you've got a smartphone. Or look for membership pack on the website, nufcmatters.com. What do you get for your one-off £25 payment? You get a scarf, a pen, and a cup, and a membership card, and entry into the monthly draw. Don't forget, if you want a car sticker, all you need to do is subscribe to the show and then email John at nufcmatters, and he will post you a free car sticker out. We're also available as a podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and other podcast providers. And we also support the Food Bank on this channel. NUFCFansFoodBank.co.uk is the virtual matchday bucket where you can make a virtual donation 365 days of the year. The new Alan Shearer raffle is underway. 150 tickets at £1 a ticket. You could win a limited edition signed Alan Shearer ball from the 260 dinner. Enter now at nufcmatters.com. We've got a few events coming up. August the 5th sees Gavin Peacock at the Tyneside Irish Centre. Tickets are £10 and you can get them now from nufcmatters.com. Our Christmas event takes place on the 7th of December at the Tyneside Irish Centre, and that's an evening with Frank Clark. Tickets are £15 and available from nufcmatters.com. Finally, Waddle, Keegan, Beardsley and friends, the Class of 84, is on at the Town Theatre and Opera House on Westgate Road in Newcastle on Thursday, January the 23rd. Tickets are now available from the Town Theatre and Opera House.co.uk or telephone 0844 2491 000. That's the box office telephone number, 0844 2491 000.